Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
Oh, thank you so much. That's so lovely to hear.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
No, it's a pleasure. You're brilliant. You're a brilliant interviewer, man.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
I really liked your questions.
You're a legend. That's beautiful.
It's best when these things just turn into a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for your lovely review. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of Words and Nerds podcast, where we chat to your favourite authors. Today we welcome Lexi Freeman, an Australian currently living in New York, author of the new book Inappropriation. This book has been described as a crackling electric prose that is sometimes uncomfortable to read. You'll laugh out loud, squirm and wince, but you sure won't put it down. The novel is an original treasure, sentence by sentence. There is just no book like it. That review is from Alyssa Nutting, author of Made for Love and Tampa, and I certainly agree with her description. Today, Lexi and I delve into this excellent book and we discuss identity politics, feminism, satire, and everything in between. I'm your host, Danny V.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Lexi. Your book, Inappropriation, was just an absolute scream to read, and I loved how it reflected society, the whole satirical part of it, and it just made me laugh pretty much all the time.
Thank you.
I love talking to people around the world. I mean, you're originally from Australia. We're chatting from Sydney to New York today, and you've been living in New York since, what, 2010?
Yeah, midway through. So I've been there. Been here 8 years.
Okay, you've still got that lovely Australian accent, but I can hear little hints of American coming through.
No, there's certain words, I was a waitress at some point, and it just became much easier to say water than water because no one could ever understand what I was saying, and just little things like that. I never wanted to lose my accent, but they just creep in. And
because there are some words that are just a complete different language, aren't they?
Yes, yeah. And Australians do just weird things also when we're in the US. Like, we sort of, like, put R's on the ends of words that shouldn't have R's there. I can't think of an example, but actually I've been watching Sacha Baron Cohen's new show, and I noticed he does it too when he's doing sort of one of his bad American accents. There's something, I don't know, the British accent, I suppose, also defaults to this, like, extraneous R sound, which I find kind of cute. Unconsciously, I want to compare myself to him some reason.
I think he'd actually really enjoy Inappropriation. I think he'd totally get it.
Yeah, I have the same feeling.
Now, the book Inappropriation, as I said, was such a fun, unique read. And I loved the review that says, you'll laugh out loud and squirm and wince, but you sure won't put it down. This was certainly my experience. And it says, this novel is an original treasure. There's no book like it. First of all, what an accurate description. And secondly, how did this idea for this book emerge?
Well, thank you. I think I started out wanting to write something about... I wanted to write a sort of date rape revenge story. I think I started writing this around the time that there was a lot of talk in the media of, catcalling. And this is sort of before Me Too, but I guess it was sort of the, like, beginnings of that moment. And so I sort of started to write a date rape revenge story, which was a kind of reversal. I got more interested in identity politics because it seemed impossible to write that story without engaging with identity politics. And so the story kind of took on a different life, although that sort of kernel of the date rape idea is still there and is still kind of a bit of an engine in the book.
I like the idea of identity politics, and it was just throughout the novel, everyone trying to find their place in the world, but everyone being so confused about what they believe in and trying not to offend anyone, which was, you know, literally impossible. And it was written in this really clever satire. And I think we all feel like this in such a connected world. I think that's why the book resonates with people, because I was like, yeah, like this is the world at the moment. And there are so many different perspectives on feminism or masculinity and even the Holocaust. And I thought, no wonder people just don't even know who they are anymore. Why was this satire so important for you to write?
Well, I guess I agree with you. I think because identity politics, although I agree with a lot of what it's saying and why it's saying, you know, why it's an important sort of movement, I feel that there's something of the pious or the sort of sacrosanct in the movement that I find a sort of problem, because you can't kind of engage difficult conversations about the ambiguity that is just inherent in any discussion of identity, and ultimately leads us to questions of what is identity and what is the self, which, you know, is obviously up for debate depending on which, you know, Western or Eastern philosophy you adhere to. So there's just, it's kind of, once you get started on identity, I think it just spirals out into some really complex conversations. And the thing that kind of, I guess, I felt triggered by in all of that was that there is some sort of claim to knowledge or sort of absolute knowledge or something within identity politics that I guess I think is false and dangerous, or at least, you know, kind of risky. And it's funny, I just was, you know, reading something about the Me Too movement and, you know, these new sort of things that are coming out, like the Asia Argento thing, and then this academic at NYU, and, you know, just the kind of complexity that we, you know, have been ignoring inside of this movement. Now these issues are kind of really surfacing, and it's a moment where we have to embrace ambiguity and I guess it feels like a good step in the right direction.
I love that idea of embracing ambiguity, because I think that you're exactly right. You know, there isn't that finite answer that everyone's looking for. And even Ziggy, you know, she says, can't you just tell me what I am? And I think she's seeking the right answer all the time. And she's such a complex character. And I loved her so much. Can you talk me through the voices of Hitler Youth in her head?
I guess that's a good question, because I feel like to me that voice is just sort of like a very strong inner critic that is basically feeding her sort of her worst case scenario in terms of an identity. She has a lot of self-consciousness about her body. She's sort of prepubescent, and the worst thing in her mind is that, you know, she feels most insulted when anyone says she looks like a boy. And so, you know, Hitler Youth transformed this in her mind into some sort of insult about, you know, transgenderism. And obviously they have, you know, they are very offensive and have no interest in being sensitive. And so it's kind of a way to kind of address some of these issues of identity confusion, you know, using a sort of like the unconscious mind, which doesn't care about, you know, political correctness or who might be offended. And you know, it's a way to kind of, I suppose, draw out some of the satire without it being, when you put it in the mouth of a young emerging Nazi in someone's mind, then, you know, you're not running the same risk as if you put it in the mouth of a middle-aged European professor or something. So I made some deliberate choices in writing a satire, you know, when talking about this kind of controversial subject matter, it made the most sense to me to have the person who's confused be a teenager who is just literally confused by all the language and all the ideas and just, you know, doesn't have the knowledge or the experience to kind of really grapple with these things, and then also has this kind of horrible sort of critical voice in her mind that's also feeding her just, you know, misinformation.
And she is such a complex character because she has all these influences around her, not only of the Hitler Youth in her mind, but her grandmother, who's a Holocaust survivor, a transgender drag queen, the Indian guru, her mother's ambiguous ideas of feminism. So it's interesting that, well, of course she's confused. And I think all of us are a bit confused because especially we're so connected now with social media. We get maybe not as extreme influences as she has, but we have all those influences ourselves too. So identity is a big deal, I think, in our current society.
Yeah. I mean, I think in some ways she's more exposed, or I deliberately made her more exposed to a variety of influences than I think most of us are, because most of us sort of live in these, you know, social media bubbles where we just hear the same ideas parroted again and again. And so I wanted that to be an aspect of the book, and it is, you know, with her kind of experiences of being online, but to have all these different characters who kind of embody different ideologies and life experiences, all kind of put on a sort of mental stage together to, you know, just have these difficult conversations and not necessarily come to any conclusions about anything, but just, you know, for all these ideas to be out there, I think is, you know, the book is just a springboard. It's not a thesis. And the rest of the work is kind of up to the reader.
Yeah, and I think novels are great when they make us ask more questions, you know, and they make us think about these things. I think that's what is important. And I find feminism really interesting part of the novel. And I really liked Ruth Klein, even though some of her ideas were very strange. And I loved how how it says, Ruth Klein says, second wave feminism made women butch and third wave made them self-loathing. And now the feminine must be reclaimed along with the murky art of seduction. Tell us about Ruth. She was such a great character.
Oh, thank you. Well, first I should say she's not my mother, because I don't want there to be any confusion about that. My mother does happen to be a psychotherapist, but she's not like Ruth. Anyway, I think Ruth is a product of her generation, or in some ways a sort of even slightly older generation of you know, baby boomers who were kind of very influenced by the counterculture and, you know, sort of came up in you know, the 60s and 70s kind of with these ideas of these ideas of the self and how to actualize or realize one's own consciousness. And she's very invested in that work, especially from the perspective of women and really getting to the heart of what a woman is kind of Ruth's, you know, work and MO. And that interested me to have her as a character, because it does feel to me like we are sort of moving towards, on the left, at least a kind of moment or of like gender neutralization, or, you know, we're sort of moving beyond feminism into a sort of moment where gender maybe should no longer really exist, and this kind of non-binary thinking. And not to say that that's not a good direction to move in, but it does feel that there is, in that kind of hastiness, there's a lot overlooked about what women are, or what, you know, like, where there's a lot of things women are afraid to talk about, I feel, and having talked to a lot of women, especially women of another generation, an older generation, you know, just a sense of being left out of the conversation of what femaleness is as it pertains to things like motherhood and, you know, and the body. And it also feels like this kind of gender non-binary sort of movement is in many ways kind of cautious of talking too much about the body, because obviously the body is pretty binary, generally speaking, you know, in terms of gender. So, I just wanted to kind of keep that voice in the conversation, because there's a lot that hasn't been said, at least kind of to the mainstream, about, you know, how we talk about women and the differences between the genders and you know, making positive attributes that are kind of considered feminine but have always been sort of talked of as less important in a kind of patriarchal capitalist system. So there's just like a lot of work, I feel, is underexplored as we rush towards some, you know, gender neutral utopia.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you with that voice and keeping that conversation open. And that's why the book was so interesting and complex, because not only did we have Ruth Klein's idea of her feminism, and then we move right over to the red pill when Ziggy starts communicating with them.
Yes. I guess I was just interested in, I mean, I'm not terribly interested in you know, red pillars or the alt-right or incels or any of that stuff, which I think comes from the darkest instincts that human beings, you know, are capable of. But I guess it felt, you know, like they're also part of this conversation and an extreme response to, you know, feminism and the advances that feminists have made over the last 40 or 50 years. So, but they also kind of represent, you know, a very vindictive sort of subculture that felt, you know, useful to have as Ziggy's kind of model for a period in the book where she becomes quite vindictive and desperate and is sort of seeking vengeance. And I liked, there was a parallel that I kind of liked between the silencing techniques of, you know, these red pillars and some of the silencing that, you know, you encounter in call-out culture on the left. And just also the way that jokes are used to silence that is definitely more something that happens on the alt-right and not so much on the left. So I felt like I definitely wanted to explore what that kind of, what, you know, what the value of humor and satire is, and also how it's dangerous and how it can be misused. And so these were questions that kind of came up for me as a writer. Obviously writing is satire and about this kind of content, and so wanting to kind of just explore it literally as Ziggy encounters it on the internet.
Yeah, and to keep that conversation authentic, you do need to add all those voices to the conversation, because that's what we're hearing, and we're so well connected that that's all coming to us, and we need a way to process that, I guess.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, I read that you began writing this book at the end of Obama's presidency and entering the Trump era. You also make mention of a female prime minister in the book who is treated horribly. I'm assuming that could be our Julia Gillard. And here we are again, if you've kept up with any news in Sydney, of yet another Lib spill and yet another prime minister. So this book just continues to be relevant, doesn't it? Tell us how the political world has influenced this book.
Well, you're the first person who's brought that up, and that's, I'm very happy to talk about that. I feel that that's really interesting because I did write the book. I started to write the book when Obama was still president, and identity politics was really, you know, having a kind of a big moment. And so it seemed okay to write a satire of identity politics in that climate. And then Trump was elected, and then it seemed maybe like a bad idea to do. but then I kind of, you know, reasoned that there's never a bad time to write a satire on a very powerful ideological movement that controls a lot or most of culture and the arts. And so it definitely still seemed like a worthwhile project. Although it's, you know, I'm not sure. It's been an interesting reception, not negative, but just I think people are still quite wary of a satire like this. And the Julia Gillard thing, the book is kind of not set exactly in the current moment. It's kind of set maybe a few years ago. Obviously, Julia Gillard's been out of office for a while, so it was sort of meant to be set. I mean, as you know, if you're reading closely, there's a few sort of contradictions in the timeline. It's mm-hmm. you know, it's a work of fiction.
Yes,
but,
yes.
But yeah, it wasn't supposed to be right now, and obviously there's no mention of Trump or anything like that in the book. But yeah, this, you know, this problem that we have with you know, the leadership spills and stuff in Australia is pretty bad. And then also, once again, it's like we didn't choose the most qualified person for the job, because that was a woman.
And it makes it timeless, you know, because I know they weren't actually mentioned by name, but you couldn't help thinking about when a woman was treated that way as a lady, you couldn't help thinking, you know, that had happened already. And then we have this other lib spiel. That's all we're talking about here at the moment. I think we're a bit over it, about, you know, democracy gone wrong.
Yeah, yeah. I guess it's different to what is happening over here in the sense of democracy also going wrong. although I guess I have a lot of, like, I don't know that, I find the fact that Americans think of what they have as democracy very strange, you know, just even the fact that voting is not compulsory to me just does not kind of make it seem, that doesn't seem very democratic. But yeah, it feels, you know, and I'm a bit far away, so I don't sort of hear enough about what's going on in Australia. I mean, I try to look on Twitter and as much as I can and see what's going on. And the last week was very exciting and depressing. but yeah, it feels like there's a lot of disillusionment coming, you know, from my friends about the political situation. And, you know, I guess the disillusionment with democracy and just with Western values and a kind of the failure of the Western humanist project. So I don't know what the answer is.
No, I don't think anyone knows what the answer is. But it's a scary place to be, because you're meant to care about politics and what's happening to your country, and they should be really important things. But I think the vibe here in Australia is we are disillusioned and people have just stopped caring. I don't have the answers either. So moving on from politics, we could be here all day. The podcast has taken a turn suddenly from fiction to politics. Talking about it is good too, because we need to keep the conversation going, so we do keep caring even though it's difficult at times. So
That's true.
Heard that you attended a similar school to the one portrayed in the book.
Well, for legal reasons, I cannot tell you the name of the school. Yeah, I did go to a private girls' school in Sydney. And, I mean, my experience there was not like the, what happens to Ziggy in the book. I mean, not only was I there before the internet, really, I mean, we didn't have email when I was at school. So there was no, you know, a lot of stuff was very different and, you know, it's a satire. So I obviously exaggerated a lot of stuff, even about just the, like, social dynamics. But, you know, It's funny, I guess watching Jermaine, Private School Girl, I always felt like that was my high school. Like, it was shocking to me that he got that so right. Just like the subtle things with just this like low level sort of racism that would go on with like Asian girls or even like Greek girls and Jewish girl. You know, it's like just very subtle and manipulative, but it was always there. And so, yeah, I guess I experienced that. And that's obviously, I don't know that you can blame the school. That's sort of the kinds of kids that the school attracts based on, you know, the location and the you know, socioeconomic factors. So I think a lot of that stuff was coming from people's parents, not really the school.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I guess a lot of my feeling about what's wrong with the world is kind of what's wrong with what happens in our homes with our families and the way that we treat each other. And I think that's where it obviously all starts. And I'm just reading this wonderful book by this feminist writer, Bell Hooks, and she's written this book called All About Love, and it's kind of a self-help book, and she's this, you know, quite serious academic. And, you know, she kind of says a lot about how we don't know how to love each other. Like, we haven't, no one, that's not something that's taught. We're taught to love, like, love is taught to us as a feeling, not as a verb. So she's kind of, you know, advocating for, you know, people really starting these practices in the home, and even things like patriarchy. Like, it really starts just in the family, and I kind of agree with that. And obviously you can bring some of that wisdom into schools, but I'm not sure how. Anyway, I guess I don't want to blame my school for too much of the bad behavior in the book, because I feel that generally it's what people learn in their homes. And, you know, if girls are bullying each other, the school steps in, and that kind of always happens. But even that, you know, that's something kids are learning in their homes. So, yeah, so I don't say this just so the school doesn't sue me. I really mean it.
No, I tend to agree to a lot. All your values are learnt at school. And even as an adult, you know, you have those voices of your parents in your head, you know, of what they taught you as a child. So I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And the idea that we don't know how to love one another, I think that's universal, isn't it? I think that's at the crux of so many of our problems at the moment. I think that's such an interesting concept. I'm going to have to read that book now.
Yeah, it's a great book. And you know, it's not like a book. Most people would probably not expect me to suggest that book. It's like nothing like my book, but I think it's really wise. And in a moment where the problems feel so huge and insurmountable, something as simple as that just feels, in a way, like, you know, one of the only tools we may have that we can, like, really actually do something practical with.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like that idea. What resonated with me, one of the things that resonated with me the most, was the fact that characters had these very specific beliefs but were quick to abandon them whenever it suited them. Do you think that that is also part of society's issue? We don't want to be inconvenienced by these things because we still kind of want to do these other things?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just human nature. And also I think there's, I suppose people can be sort of quite fickle, or I think people sort of don't, people are kind of, I feel, not like deeply interrogating their views on issues that seem kind of too contentious or too, you know, like everything's a big popularity contest online and in life. Just and so I just think a lot of ideas go unchecked because it's too potentially threatening to someone's likability to actually say what you think, and you can literally be fired if someone sees you say something online that may not be, you know, toeing some line. So I think people can be kind of fickle if they sort of feel that they might have said one thing and now they have to say the other thing, because obviously it's dangerous to think the wrong thing. I guess it feels like an intellectually sort of kind of fearful moment. I guess there's a lot of anxiety around what we should and shouldn't think, which I think is, you know, a great thing to draw attention to, or an important thing to draw attention to. So that's kind of what I think I was doing with some of these characters who change their minds very quickly. And yeah, just selfish instincts also are obviously at play there too.
Yeah, and I think that interrogation of our ideas, I think that's really important. And I think often people are overwhelmed by the information they're getting, and maybe they don't know where to get their information from. And it worries me, as it probably worries you, that people are getting information from memes or from articles that aren't well researched, and they're just picking up these kind of sound bites and not interrogating that information properly. And I think you're spot on with that.
Well, the other thing, I guess, I feel, you know, you can be the most, and this is why I find this, like, moment that, I don't know if it's probably not in the news there, but this kind of moment that's happening here with the Me Too thing and this kind of academic who's in trouble, this woman, a feminist, who's kind of on the other side of the Me Too thing as a perpetrator of abuse. I just find, like, that a very telling kind of moment in this timeline, you know, which is the moment that it doesn't matter how many texts on feminism and, you know, systemic power abuse and whatever else you've read, like how learned you are, like it's all always infinitely more complex and impossible to kind of pin down as right or wrong, or, you know, just this idea that there is a right way, and if you just read enough or the right things, or you agree or you like enough of this person on Twitter or that person, on, you know, then somehow you'll be on the side of the good. And I guess I just feel like there's no such thing, and all you can do is kind of just keep putting, like, the, I don't know, different ideas out there and sort of and listening to lots of voices and not judging anyone too harshly. And yeah, I guess that's kind of what I feel is called for now, you know, at this moment, and definitely what I was, you know, trying to do in the book, just present all of these ideas, and so many of them are kind of contradictory, and I don't know what we do with that.
Yeah, and for me that was exactly the point of the book Inappropriation, its complexity, and there is no right answer, and there are all these voices, and yet we still need to find somewhere our own identity that we are happy with and we are true to ourselves. So for me, that's exactly what the book was to me. So I'm glad that it was for you as well. I feel like I got it. Now, it's an unusual and unique book. Tell me about the publishing process, because I imagine some publishers would have been a little bit scared to touch it or hadn't seen anything like this before.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with publishing, I guess. You know, I was lucky. I have a wonderful agent, and so she sent the book around, and I think when she sends things around, people pay attention. But there was, you know, a couple of houses, publishing houses here in New York, who were nervous about the book. And, you know, the first draft of the book was definitely much rougher, and I know there would have been things in there that were probably offensive, and, you know, it was a rough first draft. And so in some ways I get it, but also it's the job of a publishing house and an editor to, you know, work with a writer on kind of ironing out their vision. But so yes, there was a little bit of that. And then there was also a bit of a concern about how to position the book, because it's a coming of age story, but it's not for young readers, it's for adults. And in a way, as I kind of said before, I chose to write a coming of age story because it felt like the right form to kind of put these ideas inside of and have them kind of play out. And in a sense, the coming of age is a metaphor for a kind of larger coming of age that culturally is sort of happening right now. So it's not really for, you know, young readers in the sense that, I mean, of course, I think relatively mature young readers will probably enjoy it or think that they got away with something by getting to read a book that's, you know, pretty dirty and weird at times. But yeah, it definitely felt like it's obviously a book for adults, and so I think publishers were a little, they were also, I think, nervous about a satire and identity politics. And even my publisher for a time was sort of positioning the book a little more as a coming of age story. And to be honest, the media, like the way the book's been received, has been disappointing in some ways, because I feel there's still resistance to just calling the book what it is. You know, there was a really nice review in the Wall Street Journal that said, you know, this is satire and identity politics, and it's good because it does this and this. And then the review in the New York Times called it a satire of high school or something, which is just totally shying away from what the book actually is and sort of misrepresents what it is. I mean, that review is very confused, but, you know, I just feel that there's definitely a tentativeness that attends, you know, publishing something like this. And people sort of, I think people appreciate the humour and some of the ideas and language and whatever. And that maybe makes it hard to, I think people are nervous to sort of promote it in a way because everyone's so concerned with being on the right side.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the book, I mean, to me, the book seems like it definitely doesn't take a side, but it's certainly not on the side of, you know, any conservative or, you know, whatever. And it's not like anti-identity politics. So anyway, I just think it's been an interesting experience publishing a book like this when there's been nothing else like it yet. And, yeah, you've seen exactly the kinds of sort of anxieties that I sort of anticipated would come up, where people sort of don't fully want to align themselves with something that, you know, they may have to, like, answer for. And it's a complex answer. And I, you know, have written interviews and pieces on that answer, but ultimately the book is the answer. And the answer is not an answer, as I've said. It's, you know, the answer is that it's too complex for there to be an answer. So having to defend that as just some, like, you know, outsider who has nothing to do with the book, I understand why people are just like, oh, I don't want to. That's, you know, that's a lot. So, yeah, so it's been kind of a weird experience. And obviously there's, you know, a lot to be grateful for. And publishing in the US is is a great thing. I'm happy that I got to do it. I can't remember, was there a second part of the question, publishing?
No, it's just about your publishing process, because I thought it might have been a tricky book to get published.
You know, it's such a funny thing, publishing a book as a woman writing about a female character, having a female protagonist, because you get into these kinds of, you know, dilemmas where you're trying to choose a book cover that's not going to turn off male readers. And this is where, you know, gender is real in the sense that you can, like, you do the numbers. Like, men do, like, people know the coding for female and male kind of, you know, directed or oriented books. And there's a whole language of, like, martini glasses and high heel shoes on the fronts of book covers and pink and, mm-hmm. you know, like, all of that stuff, and trying to come up with a cover that was not going to be too girly, because then you just kind of cancel out a whole lot of readers, was a tricky thing. And I'm not sure, you know, I felt I had to kind of argue with the publishers, you know, to try to get them to not make it look too girly. I don't like that, but it's just kind of a reality. And I don't know. I feel like for writers, it's like such a, you've got to really try to stay on top of things, because the marketing people and the publicity department at your publishing house, they know how to get attention for a certain kind of thing. But if you're doing something that's a little bit new and different, they're going to want to keep moving you back into, you know, a specific way of doing things that may really not serve what you're, you know, who you're trying to reach as an audience.
Quite like the cover. I think it's quite an original looking cover.
Well, because you've got the red cover,
yes,
right?
Yes, I do, yep. So what's next for you? Have you got another book in the pipeline, or are you having a bit of a rest from this identity politics? Are you going to go something totally different and write a thriller or something?
I'm not going to write another book on identity politics, but I do have another book that I've started to work on, which it's hard to talk about because it's very new, and I'm not fully sure which direction it's going to go in. But it's kind of a little bit, I suppose, about Me Too, but not really. Specifically Me Too, but sort of about a culture of cancelling people, mm-hmm. and it's set in New York. So, but I don't know. It may go somewhere quite different in the end. Excellent.
Well, I look forward to reading it when that is eventually finished and complete. But thank you so much, Lexi, for your time. The book Inappropriation for me was just such a wild read, and it was a great laugh, and it really does serve as a reflection of modern society and how complex our lives have become, I think. And I've loved hearing the New York traffic in the background. It's made it really authentic for me. I love New York. I've only been there twice, but each experience has been really special, and I love that. I've romanticised it a bit in my mind, so I enjoyed that too.
Lovely. The traffic is very authentic. It's right there.
I've been hearing the horns beeping, and I'm like, oh, that's great. Thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. It was really, really fun to talk about. And I really appreciate it.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.